Hello everyone, Eric Filion here from the Department of History at Queen's University. This is the third of five episodes prepared for Curating for Change, the work that music festivals do in the world, a two-part online conference hosted by the University of Guelph and Queen's University. We held the first part at the end of August, and part two will take place on October 14th and 15th. Our primary objective with this conference is to bring together a diverse set of perspectives to extend our understanding of the work that independent, artist-run, or boutique music festivals do in promoting vital forms of activist arts-based practices, pedagogies, and community making. This new episode is an interview I conducted with Anna Saint-Ange on September 13, 2022. She joined me on Zoom from North Bay, Ontario, to talk about her work on the archival records of the Mariposa Folk Festival, a Canadian institution founded in 1961 and still active today. Anna Saint-Ange is an archivist at York University who most recently served as Director of Digital Scholarship Infrastructure. She holds a BA in History and Celtic Studies and a Master's of Information Studies degree with a specialization in archival studies and book history and print culture, both from the University of Toronto. Her current research focuses on archival praxis and reminiscence therapy for people living with dementia, in a collaborative archives project with the Ojibwe Cultural Foundation on Manitoulin Island. Anna, thank you for joining me today to talk about York University Libraries / Clara Thomas Archives and Special Collections. Really one of my favorite places to do research at, both in person and remotely.
Super, thanks. Good to hear. Although I hear our reading room is very chilly. Bring your sweater.
So my first question is, I'm curious to know what your initial reaction was when you first examined the Mariposa Folk Festival archives back in, it would have been 2007, 2008. And so I'm curious to know what struck you the most about its content.
My understanding was that the festival records were donated in, ended up at the university at around 2007. And it was the result of a series of negotiations between the festival board and the university. I didn't join the university full-time until about 2009. So prior to that, I would have seen the records on the shelf, but not really have responsibility for it. So the story, as I understood it from other colleagues at the archives, was that the festival had approached a number of large archives about this potential donation. They knew their records were important. And some of the longtime volunteers with the festival, so people who had served on the board for many years, were alumni of York. So there was that connection there. And the materials were also a really strong match to the archives collection mandate. So every archival institution is going to have strengths. And because York has a strong legacy of fine arts performance and musicology, it really made sense. It was definitely a prestige acquisition for the university. And I just remember being struck by how much space they took up. So my colleague, Sean Smith, who now works at the Archives of Ontario, was someone who was involved in helping to transfer the materials out of various offices and the storage units to the university. So with Sean Smith and the current university archivist at York, Michael Moyer, they were some of the people that helped get the materials into the custody of the university archives. I just have this really distinct memory of opening the collapsing shelves in the archives and just seeing a whole range, a stretch of highway just full of archival records.
So yeah, I mean, you just described a stretch of highway. How big was the fall initially, and what can you tell me about how it was organized? And for people who are not used to going into archives, how do you measure such a fall, or how do you describe the volume of material that you have?
Yeah, so I mean, there's a number of ways we could describe it. Archivists will talk about extent. So in the States, we'll talk about yards. In Canada, we'll talk about meters of extent. So there was about over 300 boxes. So 300 is usually a pretty good unit to start working with. But of course, these were unprocessed materials. When we got down to starting the processing, you're going to find a lot of duplication. Things are going to become more compact. And hopefully our goal of the archives is sort of to, working with the records creators, get a sense of how materials were used in the moment, and then what records have lasting historical and research value. So over the years, that 300 boxes of materials has been reduced as we sort of sort things out, and getting records into sort of secure environments, especially audio recordings. We wanted to make sure that they were in stable boxes and, where possible, digitized.
New accruals have been added to the fund, though, right? Since it was acquired in 2007, there is an acquisition custodial history. And so maybe, are we back to the initial 300 now or beyond that? Or
so it's more. And I would estimate that the university receives maybe like a meter or so of organizational records every few years from the festival staff. And we also get, so sometimes the festival has reached out to longtime volunteers. So people who may not be part of the formal administration of the foundation, but they deposit materials that they had a hand in generating. So people who are involved in important parts of the festival. And another element are festival volunteers and just festival goers who approach us with their own records. So if people have their own photographs of the event, those will get donated, but as sort of adjacent records, complimentary foam that informed the official record of the festival.
So you wrangled the festival's records when you started working at York University Libraries. It was one of the first projects that you worked on. So what was that process like?
So when I was first hired at York, it was my first assignment. Now, previous to me taking up the work, there had been part-time archivists, including, I believe, Jennifer Grant and Allison Black. They had done some sort of piecemeal processing of the materials, working with student assistants. So we knew the 50th anniversary of the festival was coming up. So we really focused on trying to get grant funds that would help us digitize material in the hope of promoting the history of the festival. So the foundation was heavily involved in supporting those grant applications. And there was always an element of sort of a balance of getting the records into shape that they could be easily accessed by researchers, but working in tandem to really support the promotional side of the festival.
So that's the backstory, I guess, to the online exhibit Mariposa Celebrating Canadian Folk Music, which is still live on the University Library's website. I'm not going to spell out the URL. It's way too long, so people can just go to Google and type online exhibit Mariposa Celebrating Canadian Folk Music and they'll find it. So I guess that was part of the incentive to get started on organizing or going through the phone, because the online exhibit was launched for the 50th anniversary. Is that correct?
It is, yeah. You can get a huge donation of records, but then have the freedom to sort of process it in obscurity. With Mariposa, there was definitely sort of like we really need to promote this prestige donation. And the online exhibit that we were planning on doing was sort of the Mariposa themselves. They did the foundation, they produced like a booklet, and they did a series of, they were working with local journalists to produce a series of articles. Mm-hmm. And then we did some cross promotional materials. But it was definitely sort of a balance of preservation and accessibility. As an archivist, I always want to be trying to ensure that the records are safe, they're secure, the chain of custody is documented, and that a researcher can show up at our front door and be able to find what they need and be assured that what they've been promised, nothing's been added, nothing's been taken away without documentation. One of the challenges was I was working with the development officer, Tan Ling Yung, and we approached a bunch of foundations for funding, and we were successful with a federal grant that only allowed for digitization for the purposes of public access. So understandably, if the federal government is giving money, they want to have sort of some kind of manifestation of those funds. So we really tried to prioritize materials that the foundation had copyright over, photographs where we knew that the photographers were under contract with the festival. So the foundation had rights over those images. We also worked with newspaper photographs that the university holds from the Toronto Telegram, and the university controls the copyright of most of those images as well. What was challenging, I had a fairly rudimentary understanding of copyright, Canadian copyright in particular, and working with the materials, really sort of not a clash, but sort of coming into conversation with how intellectual property and copyright operates for performance. We worked really hard to sort of balance the digitization that we could get done in the timelines of the grant and sort of hedging our bets about which artists we were hopeful would give permission to make those recordings available for free on the open web, and working within the ecosystem of managers and licensing people. But I had a lot of support from the legal counsel at the university. So they were able to sort of draft an agreement that we could bring to festival performers and sort of bring the conversation down to this idea of like sharing historical material, promoting people's work through this exhibit in a way that became more feasible under the grant. And it helped us not get entangled in additional contracts and obligations.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a commercial venture. Only, maybe that number has changed now, but only 10% of the materials have been digitized, I think. And is that only for audio recordings or audio recordings and photographs? Where are we at right now in terms of the percentage of materials that's been digitized? And what are some of the ongoing challenges there?
Yeah, I think, well, the first thing to remember is that, well, we will never be aiming for 100% digitization, especially for something like Mariposa. I know you can appreciate as a researcher that there's a lot of sort of meaning making and sort of intangible knowledge that you can infer in the reading room with materials, like how they look, how they appear together. And with festivals, I'm sure people who are listening can appreciate too, there's just a lot of ephemeral material that once you start scanning stuff or trying to tease out the nuance of those materials in a digital environment, it sort of collapses. You sort of lose a lot of meaning, and the archival bond between materials can be lost or be very challenging to document. I think with Mariposa, our biggest challenge, or it's not a challenge, but our focus, our priority, are those live recordings that are on quarter inch open reel tape and quite a bit of material on audio cassette. So I would say we're maybe a little higher than 10% these days, but it's not as high as I would like. And there continues to be a lack of resourcing. So where all archival institutions struggle with funding, sustainable funding, and the challenges of applying for grants, public funds, donations, where it's just for preservation, where it's hard to give certain kinds of donors or grant funders that manifestation that they can say, oh, I gave this amount of money and now this amount of material is visible and freely available to all. Because a lot of the preservation is just to stabilize material that, yeah.
I mean, reel-to-reel tapes, you know, it's fairly stable, but you likely have to have them digitized elsewhere. I don't know if you're doing this in-house.
We did a lot of DIY for this project. And the Mariposa, the 50th anniversary, we piloted a lot of digital preservation strategies within the archives. So we had, I worked with three graduate students, CJ Tsai, Ryan Bruce, and Kyle Brenders. They're all from the music department at York, and they helped with digitization. So they worked with playback equipment that was held at the Sound and Moving Image Library at York. So we had playback equipment. I think Ryan, actually, his father-in-law or one of his relatives, like, donated their own playback equipment, and we did a lot of digitization in-house. Mm-hmm.
So you just talked about collaborating or getting graduate students involved. I'm assuming you also collaborated with people in various departments, perhaps historians while working on this project. Certainly people at outside academia, if we're thinking about people from Mariposa. But how important was it to be able to bring these different parties together?
With the project itself, I had a lot of support from Catherine Brennan, and then of course, like Pam Carter, Chris Hazel, Christopher Lesty were also very supportive in subsequent years with permissions and support. Other people was working, like working with Cy Botma, so knowing that he would always be transferring material every year and it would be excellent quality, solid file naming conventions and a good file format. I was really lucky to rely on those relationships and the continuation of those volunteers going in year after year to support the festival. And I think working, I was able to sort of talk to Ruth McVeigh. So she was Ruth Jones when she founded the festival. So she was a great source of insight and context. Just very generous with her time to explain the foundations of the festivals and her motivations for making things happen.
So there was another exhibit that was held alongside or probably shortly after the online exhibit. And it was called, or the title was Mariposa Folk Festival, 50 Years of Folk Music. And it was held at the Market Gallery in Toronto. Can you tell me a bit about it?
Sure. So that exhibit was something I pulled together with the support of Zija Tsai. So she was a musicologist and a graduate student who had helped with some of the rights clearances for the online exhibit. So she was able to sort of provide some subject knowledge to help frame the exhibit in person. I also had some really good help from Vito Sirocco, who's a member of the Sound and Moving Image Library, just to sort of pull things together and help with the installation. And the Market Gallery people were really amazing for logistical support. I think having those kinds of partnerships where experts can be helping with the framing and hanging of content, so you can just sort of focus on the material, the story you want to tell. So I had great help from Michael Dubenka. I think that's how you pronounce his name. I apologize, Michael, if it's wrong. And Pamela Wachner, who was the curator at the time. So just knowing that the archives was looking for opportunities to promote the material and providing that space. So archivists tend to be generalists, and we have to be generalists in many ways. So sort of connecting with those curatorial experts really helped us with some polish to the exhibit. And we had a great turnout because, as you know, like the festival was held in Toronto for several critical years as well. It's a moving back and forth between Orillia. So there was a real, we had sort of a built-in audience of people who had gone to the festival in their during their teens and early adulthood. So it was also a different way to tell the story of the festival and create a space where people could come together and sort of share their own stories, which isn't always possible in the online environment.
And so that event was documented, I guess, and it's probably now part of the Mariposa Folk Festival Fund.
So it sort of, it also got boxed and put in with the materials as well. So, it pulled in a few donations that we may not have had otherwise. So the performer and the scholar, so George Sawa, who was a performer at the festival and a teacher in Toronto, he had a sort of candid photo of himself photobombing Bob Dylan. So that was, everybody tells the story about the year Bob Dylan showed up at the festival, but we didn't have any documentation in the festival records of his presence. So having the exhibit sort of brought in those donations that were a strong sense of like the oral history of the festival. We didn't have any physical evidence. Mm-hmm. So I would want to share too that the work that went into the 50th anniversary promotions, it helped build the case for the libraries investing more staffing and resourcing to develop a digital preservation infrastructure. So we sort of cut our teeth with Mariposa in some ways, but it really helped build the case for if we want to be acquiring these kind of records, if we want to be making these materials available in a useful way, we need to be investing more in in digital preservation and getting the people in place who can help with that work. And the initial sample of digitized material has formed the foundation of additional scholarship. I think I talked about some graduate students who have built their dissertations on these materials, and certainly the foundation has built on the promotional work and the official histories based on this material. Another example is Dr. Stacey Allison Casson, who, along with Jamie Lee Morin, worked with the Mariposa materials to study the Native Stage, which was curated by Alanice Bobsewin in the 1970s. So really, really interesting, like micro history within the festival. So working with the content that was already digitized, they were able to expand and mobilize information contained within the festival records to document the work of Indigenous artists who were active on the folk music scene during this time. Yeah, so just that it's just that initial sample just continues to expand and allow people to ask different kinds of questions.
So you have written and given talks about archiving from below. Can you tell me a bit more about this concept and how it may apply to artist communities and cultural organizations?
Yeah, absolutely. Archiving from below, it is a concept that's borrowed from historians, and just to characterize efforts to preserve archives and documentation of popular movements and community-driven activities. So trying to document the lives of ordinary people rather than focusing solely on the records of social and political elites. I think thinking about festivals in this context is really, I think it's really helpful. I think there can be a lot of richness and value in documenting decision-making and the experience of audiences beyond what is immediately required for auditing and grant writing requirements. So absolutely, I think the festival records that York University holds, I think it's really important for just basic record keeping. So what grants did you apply for? Why did the festival go in this direction or that direction over time? What I have seen, though, in the richness is sort of expanding that in some ways. And that's in part of the responsibility of archival institutions. I'm not necessarily suggesting that festivals start collecting the records of audience members and this, that, and the other. Your primary focus should be, like, how is the festival documenting its decision-making? And then how can archival institutions help enrich that or find those additional pockets of documentation that enrich and sort of expand what's available for practitioners, researchers, other artists to encounter in the archives? Because I think, too, that the studying historical moments, particular historical moments, or knowing something that you're involved in is important, not only to you, but you feel the historical importance of whatever you're involved in, what needs to be preserved so that a new generation can remix or replicate what you're trying to create or understand your motivations. It doesn't necessarily have to be resource intense. It needs to be like a degree of self-awareness, which I think a lot of artists have.
So thinking about what you've been talking about, what would you tell artists and festival organizers or curators to encourage them to think more deeply about their private and institutional archives with an eye and perhaps an ear on the future?
I would let artists and festival organizers, curators, those types of folks, really think about the third-party applications and the host services that you're using to generate and store important files. So what rights do you have to download your content and to store it elsewhere? When you're working with archival institutions, there may not be the mandate or the resourcing for an archival institution to maintain those subscriptions. And when some of those services, they're profit-driven, they're going to ask for a subscription every year, it's not feasible. So how can you take advantage of those services or those platforms but have a backdoor, have a means of extracting your material and having custody and control over that content? So that can also relate to social media. It could relate to just using suites like Google Suite and that sort of thing to organize your event. I want people to think about your archival record and how it might be preserved through time. So, and absolutely working within your capacity. So if you have limited resources, think about these in terms of networks of like-minded people. So determining what's the most important documentation to preserve and working within your budget. It's not very glamorous, but you could blow your whole operating budget preserving a single year of live performances. Or you could be thinking about, okay, we care about the work that we're doing. We care about the space that we're creating for performers and artists. How can we capture? Do we capture the whole thing? Do we capture snippets? Do we make those sort of hard choices about preservation? And how can you sort of establish networks of mutual aid to create that foundation for preservation? Nobody is going to be able to preserve like the National Archives, right? In some ways. So how can we be building networks of mutual aid to be contributing to sort of collective efforts to preserve material? How can we be building relationships with archival institutions that help build capacity, help hire people full time so they can be working on preservation for a whole range of materials? And I think something else pretty practical is just like consider setting aside a portion of your operating budget for preservation and archival work. A lot of institutions these days are asking for cash donations to accompany archival donations to help with processing. If people aren't prepared for that ask, it can be very off-putting. And sometimes institutions insisting on a cash donation, it already creates potential marginalization, right? If you're a DIY group that's setting up these events on a shoestring and you go to an institution, they're like, well, we want you to donate 10 grand. It sort of ends the conversation there. So thinking about like where is your community of like-minded people and how can we start working within those communities to preserve those historical traces of work that really means a lot to us and reflects work that's being done? Because we'll find sometimes within a generation, people don't, if those archival traces aren't preserved, and this can be formal preservation or just passing on that knowledge, people lose a connection. They don't understand how something was done or how did people come together and set up this festival. Preserving those records can be like a gift to the next generation. They may be doing, it might be a different musical movement, it might be a different genre, but having that documentation can help people understand like, oh, I can do it too.
That was Anna Saint-Ange speaking about the institutional archives of the Mariposa Folk Festival. What is the work that music festivals do in the world? Could music festivals spark changes in behaviors or institutions? What about policies or even ways of being? Please join us for our online conference featuring artists, scholars, practitioners, and organizers. Co-hosted by the University of Guelph and Queen's University, Curating for Change, the Work That Music Festivals Do in the World is an online conference that will take place on October 14th and 15th. To find out more, visit whatmusicfestivalsdo.ca.